Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, more movement on healthcare reform is spotted, but will it amount to anything? Also, a discussion with Greta Christina on an atheist view of sexuality, and a segment on Now on PBS's take on abortion and anti-choice Democrats. Jessica Valente posted a trailer for a show called The Roe Effect that looks interesting. I'll see if I can watch it soon and if it merits a report on the podcast.
In Washington today, President Palin announced the nomination of 2 Supreme Court justices.
I'm guessing it's a dystopian story, but it also seems very sad and very personal, which is the best way to tell these kinds of stories. Healthcare reform. For those of us hoping for an Obama offensive, there is some hope on the horizon. The White House released an 11-page document creating a path towards reconciling the House and Senate bills and arranged a summit on Thursday with the express desire to hear Republican ideas, but mainly to show that for Republicans, ideas are something they prefer to keep in abstraction and not move on. Because of this, the conservative media machine was screaming one word over and over, trap!
The Republicans have got to be very, very careful here, because this is nothing more than a trap. And the Republicans, I'm saying it right now, do not be afraid of being called the party of no if you don't do this.
That was Rush Limbaugh, and what he says goes, apparently, because the conservative media started to echo the accusation all over.
Yeah, Rush is right. Of course, it's a trap. There's such a deep chasm and wide chasm over the goals and the objectives of health care reform in this country. But it's also a great, great opportunity for the Republican Party.
That was Peter Johnson on Fox News. I have a ton of examples of this, but I won't belabor the point. What I find baffling is that to cry trap is to claim the mantle of weakness and stupidity. The official line from the Republicans filibustering the health care bill is that they want to pass health care reform, but can't because Democrats didn't listen to their super excellent, super secret ideas. To say that an invitation to share those ideas is a trap is to basically admit that you don't actually have ideas and were bluffing because coming straight out and saying that 46 million uninsured in this country can kiss off and die is a bad political move. That is 15% of Americans, after all. The outrage, then, is at having the bluff called. I've been a political junkie my whole life, and I wasn't aware that there was some deep moral obligation when your opponent is bluffing and engaging in deep dishonesty to play along and allow them to win the argument by cheating. Even if we were playing by poker rules and bluffing is allowed, then since the game has reached an impasse and no more bets are on the table, then it's time for Republicans to show their cards. The funny thing is that no matter how much Limbaugh whines about this, and no matter how much Fox News echoes his whine, the actual politicians in this case know that refusing to show up would indeed send the signal that they're weak and have no ideas. So even if this is true, they can't miss it. Mitch McConnell admitted as much.
Let's get it on the record. Will you attend the president's health care reform summit on Thursday?
Yeah, I think in all likelihood I'll be there. We're discussing the sort of the makeup of the room and that sort of thing. But yeah, I intend to be there and my members will be there and ready to participate.
Okay, that's enough horse race watching. What are the actual policy issues at stake in all this shifting and debate? Well, despite the overwhelming popularity of the public option with the American people, that was not in the White House plans. The whole point of the public option is to control costs through competition, especially now that insurance companies are just pushing through rate hikes left and right for no other reason than they want to have even more record-breaking profits. Here, let the president explain.
The other week, men and women across California opened up their mailboxes to find a letter from Anthem Blue Cross. The news inside was jaw-dropping. Anthem was alerting almost 1 million of its customers that it would be raising premiums by an average of 25%, with about a quarter of folks likely to see their rates go up by anywhere from 35 to 39%. Now, after their announcement stirred public outcry, Anthem agreed to delay their rate hike until May 1st, while the situation is reviewed by the state of California. But it's not just Californians who are being hit by rate hikes. In Kansas, one insurance company raised premiums by 10 to 20% only after asking to raise them by 20 to 30%. Last year, Michigan Blue Cross Blue Shield raised rates by 22% after asking to raise them by up to 56%.
However, as Susie Madrak at the link offered on the notes page pointed out, the Obama administration's response doesn't make a lot of political sense. They're wanting a federal board to control rate hikes for insurance companies. This is instead of offering more competition. Being the cynic that I am, I can't help but think the choice is due to some lobbying by insurance companies. Perhaps they fear competition more than regulation because regulators can be lobbied, but competitors not so much. Maybe I'm wrong. I hope so. I'd like to welcome Greta Christina to the program. Greta is a freelance writer who's written for books, magazines, online, you name it. She focuses on sexuality and atheism and is becoming one of the strongest voices of online atheism. She recently caught my attention with a marvelous talk about atheism and sexuality that she gave at Purdue, and so I asked her to come on the show and talk about the subject some more. Welcome to RealityCast, Greta.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
What I loved about your talk, first of all, was that it happened at all. You see a lot...
Me too. It's like there's this part of me that was so tickled that I get to go to Indiana and talk about atheism and sex. It's just like some sort of dream job. I couldn't believe I was lucky enough to get to do it.
Well, you know, in the Midwest, I think they're really hungry for that sort of thing.
It's true. Although, you know, I was very surprised, actually, at how sexually advanced the students were at Purdue, and I also gave a talk at Indiana University the day before. And one of the things that was really blew me away about it was, you know, this is Indiana, and yet these kids are totally comfortable with homosexuality and bisexuality and sex work and polyamory and sadomasochism and all these issues that we've all been fighting for decades. They're down with it. Admittedly, they're college students, so that's not exactly representative, but it was just very encouraging to realize that a lot of the work that, you know, sexual activists and feminists have been doing and gay activists have been doing for years and decades is, in fact, paying off.
Well, and I thought what was interesting is you see a lot of writing out there about sexuality that doesn't reference faith at all, mm-hmm. and you see a lot of writing about sexuality from the perspective of being religious.
Yes.
And it's not that atheists don't write about sex, but they kind of keep the two in different buckets. You rarely see anyone talking about it in an intersectional way.
Yeah, it's true.
Why do you think that is?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think, and I'll have to think about that to really give a good answer. I think to some extent, atheists, like everybody else, have a certain reticence to talk about sex. They think it's unseemly or trivial or just, you know, that, you know, it's, oh, we don't just want to do the sex issue because that makes us look silly or whatever. But also I think that when atheists do talk about sex, there's a certain, you don't just want to be doing the Welder's Review of Flashdance all the time. You don't want every single thing you write about to be the atheist view of whatever, you know, what's the atheist view of, you know, the best way to make a pumpkin pie, you know. But I do think that sex is such an important arena of human life, and it's an arena of human life that religion has really gotten to control. And not just conventional religion. I mean, to a great extent, the conversation about sex has been controlled by a conventional religion for centuries, millennia. But even the sex-positive movement it's very much, not controlled, but it's very much influenced by this sort of New Age sexuality and, you know, the tantric orgasms and honoring the goddess with our pleasure and, you know, the meditation, masturbation kind of thing. And I think that if atheists are going to make any headway in making atheism more accepted and more understood, we really do need to present a view of sexuality that isn't just completely secular, that doesn't have anything to do with religion, but that says this is how we view sexuality without religion in a positive way.
Well, and I think what's really interesting about that, and it's a really good place to kind of talk about like how morality is formed outside of a religious framework, because sex is obviously, no matter what your view is, it's something that has to be looked at in a moral framework. And it's not like there, you know, can't be sexual morality even if you don't believe in gods. Can you talk some about some of the ways that sexual morality forms outside of a religious belief system?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the most standard religious view of morality, of course, is that God really cares what kind of sex you have, and that he has this list of checklist of do's and don'ts. And it's a checklist of do's and don'ts that is somewhat unrelated to issues of real morality or even real practicality. I mean, some of them are, but a lot of, when you look at religious taboos on sex around the world and throughout history, it's almost random. It's pretty much just, you know, like the God in this part of the world picked out of a hat what he wants you to do and not do, and then the God in the other part of the world. It's almost like a completely random choice. So I think that an atheist or godless view of sexual morality, it can be based on actual morality. What are human ethical values? What do we value? What do we think is good? What do we think is bad? In any context, you know, there's been a lot of research. It's somewhat new research, and so I don't want to rely on it too much. But there's a lot of research in being done into what are basic human ethics. What are the ethics that are hardwired into us as a social species, and that seem to be cross-cultural and cross-historical? And what a lot of people are looking at is, you know, it's questions like what's fair and not fair, what hurts people and what doesn't hurt people, what's honest. And those are, I think, the kinds of questions that we can look at with sexual morality. You know, when you're looking at, for instance, a question about same-sex marriage, for instance, you know, we don't have to look at what does God think about it. What we can say is, well, is this something that hurts anybody? Is this something that hurts the individuals involved? Is it something that is in any way harmful to society? Does it cause society to be unstable? Is it fair to have different rules for same-sex couples than it is for non-same-sex couples? And with almost any sexual question of morality, we can look at these questions. What hurts people and doesn't hurt people? What's fair and isn't fair? What causes society to be stable versus unstable? What's loyal to people? What's honest? A question that's come up in my writing is a question of cheating in a monogamous relationship. And the question is, if one partner in a relationship has decided they don't want to have sex anymore ever, and they're not willing to discuss it, it's not a temporary thing because they're sick or depressed or something like that, they're done with sex, and because it's a monogamous relationship, they think their partner should be done with sex too, and they're not willing to do couples counseling or anything like that, does the other partner have a right to look for sex outside the relationship, even though that's not what they agreed on? And what I think you need to look at in that situation, I think it's a very tricky ethical question, because on the one hand, a very important ethical value is that you keep your promises. And if you promise to be monogamous, you should stay monogamous. But I also think that it's unethical for one person to non-consensually decide that another person can never have sex again. I think that's a really harmful, that's something that really causes harm, and it's not fair. It's very much unjust. And so this is sort of this, I'm not sure that I have an answer to that question, but what I think is important for people to look at is to say, this is kind of a nuanced question. We can't just look at this in terms of the rules that God handed down. This is this nuanced ethical question that different people who are good people with good intentions might answer differently.
A lot of the time, atheists in liberal movements like the pro-sexuality movement, the gay rights movement, the feminist movement are kind of quietly encouraged to shut up about our because we're seen as harmful to appealing to an overall objective of appealing to mainstream America. How do you feel about that?
Really, really irritated is how I feel about that. Yes, I think that that's true. I think that I've certainly seen it in the LGBT movement, and I've certainly seen it in the pro-sex movement. There is this idea that you know, they kind of want the ACS to shut up because we make the movement look bad. And they want us to, especially you see this in the LGBT movement, where they want the movement to seem like we're just like regular Americans, we pay our taxes, we believe in God, just like everybody else. And I think also it's seen as a threat to ecumenicalism. With progressive religious believers, there's very much this strong value that you don't question other people's beliefs, that you know, you say, oh, I'm a Christian, and you're a Jew, and you're a Hindu, and you're a Wicca, but that's okay, we can all get along. It's all basically the same God, it's the same thing that we're worshiping, we're just coming at it from different angles, and we can all work together. And then atheists come along and say, we think you're all wrong. We don't agree with any of you, and we think that this is a valid thing to be discussing, and we don't have to talk about it all the time. We can set it aside while we're working on strategy around same-sex marriage, but if you're going to ask us what we think about it, we think that religion is mistaken, we think that it's valid to discuss. We think it's a hypothesis about the world that's worth subjecting to questions of evidence and reason. And so we threaten their sort of vision of polite ecumenicalism that doesn't ever question other people's religious beliefs because it's seen as impolite at best and actually intolerant at worst. And I think you're right that it also is seen as, you know, undercutting our attempts to make ourselves seem like just normal Americans. But the reality is that, first of all, we are here, and if you're going to be a diverse movement, you need to accept everybody who's within the movement and listen to their voices. And it's also the case that America is becoming a less God-fearing country. You look at statistics about people, about religious belief, and religious belief is going down in this country, and it's especially going down among young people. So I think that when progressive movements and such as the LGBT movement, the feminist movement, the sex positive movement try to shut up atheists, you know, they're alienating a movement that is pretty strong and that's growing every day, and that's one of the most fast-growing social change movements that's on the ground right now. And I think it's kind of short-sighted to alienate us. Now, I agree that it's a hard issue to do alliance work around. It's a hard issue because the fact is we are saying, you're wrong. There is no God. There is no soul. It's just the physical world, and that's all there is, and everybody who believes in this is mistaken. That is what we're saying, and there's no nice way around that. And I think sometimes it's valid to table the issues that you don't agree on in order to work together on the issues that you do agree on. But, you know, in the LGBT movement especially, it's like they try so hard to be inclusive, but this isn't a community that they seem very interested in being inclusive of, and I do think that's a problem.
So one more question kind of related to that. Like, on top of inclusivity, which I think is something I think everyone can agree on, if they thought about it, do you think that atheists have I know there's a lot of diversity with atheists, I'm not denying that, but do you think that atheists have something unique that they can add to these kind of movements? Because, you know, certainly Christians and other believers say, like, I can speak to people where they're at, on top of, like, inclusivity, I can argue with them on scripture or whatever. Do you think atheists have something specific that we could add?
I think we do. I think that atheists have a passion for reality that I think is a real bonus to any social change movement. And that's not to say that believers don't care about reality and are all living in a fantasy world. But atheists have this absolute driving passion for what is really true. They're not interested in wishful thinking. They're not interested in a good example. I'll stay away from the abstractions here. There's been this ongoing discussion in the LGBT movement and in the sex positive movement about whether sexual orientation is born or learned or both. And, you know, is it genetic? Is it something that's acquired in utero? Is it gender roles and sexuality that's learned from society, etc.? And these debates and discussions have largely been taking place in a context of what would be politically expedient for the movement. You know, is it better politically to say we're born this way, we can't help it? Or is it better for us to say this is, you know, sexuality is entirely the social construct and, you know, gender roles are the social construct and it has, you know, therefore it's a civil rights issue for that reason. And a lot of what people have been ignoring is what does the science say? What does the actual research say? What is the truth of this question? You know, the question of is sexual orientation born or learned, that's a question that probably has an answer. And it's probably a complicated, multifactorial answer, but it probably has an actual answer. And what I think atheists bring to this movement is we're the people who are always saying, what does the research say? What does the evidence say? What do the arguments say? And we're the ones who are saying, we can't reach the conclusion first and then come up with a really good set of apologetics to explain why that conclusion is okay. We're the ones who are saying what's really true, and that's what we have to work with. And I think that that's important for any movement, because I think that if we get any movement gets too far into navel-gazing and too far into wishful thinking and looking at reality entirely through the eyes of political expedience, that's always ultimately going to be damaging.
You can read more from Greta at her blog, gretachristina.typad.com. She blogs there on a very regular basis, but also links to her writings elsewhere. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Greta.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much for having me. This was really fun.
Now on PBS did a program on the new influx of anti-choice Democrats and how this badly damaged the healthcare bill and the process. It was an excellent segment interviewing providers, patients, and politicians like Howard Dean and Bart Stupak. As usual, Stupak was a maddening blowhard who spoke mostly from ignorance about an issue he claims to feel deeply about. But before I get to his comments, I thought I'd talk a little bit about the anti-choice taxonomy of women. I developed this taxonomy after years of observing anti-choicers, and I've determined that they put women into three basic categories: the feminists, good women, and the dupes. The feminists are the Jezebels of this taxonomy. We're assumed to have no goodness in us, but to be motivated strictly for mercenary reasons, such as making money and wanting sex, and other motivations that aren't considered so evil if they motivate men. Call us the unwomen in this taxonomy. Then there are the dupes, who antis appear to believe are most American women. They are assumed to be stupid and duped by feminist stories about liberation and independence. But according to antis, they don't know what they really want, and so they do things like get abortions because they're too dumb to know that they really want to have the baby. So they'll have to be forced for their own good. Then there are the good women. These are women that accept that they're too stupid to think for themselves and instead follow the rules of a patriarchal church and submit to men's direction and care. I bring this up for context for one of Bart Stupak's comments.
They're raising money off me, and there's the beatbartstupaks.com and all this other good stuff. And I'm sure glad they're using it for their fundraising purposes. So it doesn't bother me.
Yeah, he all but patted us on the head, called us little ladies, and accused us of crying as blackmail. The complete disregard for women's well-being is second in offensiveness only to the assumption that feminists are in this strictly for the money. I can't tell if Stupak thinks the anger is faked or if he just thinks that the little ladies are hysterical, but either way, it's clear that he thinks we're full of it. Which I would argue stems from a larger framework where women's opinions and beliefs are considered illegitimate, at least when they differ from patriarchal instructions on how to behave. Take Stupak's image of pro-choicers as being sleazy Jezebels who only care about money and don't really care about other people, and contrast that image with this interview with a clinic worker in Pennsylvania.
One of the protesters publishes a newsletter and sends it to prisoners convicted of killing doctors, bombing clinics, and assaulting abortion providers. That protester knows exactly where Boulanger lives.
I don't feel safe. I'm targeted by a terrorist who pickets my home, and so I don't feel like I can sit in my living room with the shades open at night.
oh, but in Stupak's world, she's just some sleazeball who tricks stupid women into having abortions for money. Look, there's a lot of professions where these folks could make a lot of money if they had no moral stake. They could be plastic surgeons or other specialists in narrow, super profitable fields. Ones where their home addresses weren't being marketed to terrorists. That they persist is due to their sincere belief, one I share, that women are full human beings who have a right to make their own decisions, and that women are not simply walking wombs. Stupak's obliviousness and stereotyping extends far beyond that. He dismisses concerns that women who want abortions won't be able to pay for them, suggesting that there is more than enough private funds for them. I guess it's because he thinks feminists are swimming in cash from selling out our femininity to the devil or something. But in reality, the situation is quite dire.
Well, I have three children, so we're barely making ends meet now, so.
Do you have any insurance at all?
No, I don't.
Only 17 states pay for abortions for low-income women. Pennsylvania is not one of them.
I see that you've rescheduled a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
Was this due to not being able to come up with the rest of the money?
Yeah.
For poor women who decide to have an abortion, the issue is often cost, whether she has a family like Jane or is on her own like Tina. The average price for an abortion is $400 to $500 for the first trimester.
I found I was pregnant about 2 months ago, so this was like a savings thing, you know, and I'm trying to beat time, you know, it was just hard. And all trying to do it before I reach that 12-week period.
Tina has been putting away $20 to $30 a week for the past 2 months. She has a job in the customer service department of an insurance company, but her wages are low enough to qualify her for Medicaid.
The simple-minded view of women that propels the anti-choice movement is all over this story, and is in my mind the most undercovered aspect of the debate. If anti-choicers embrace the view pro-choicers have of women as full human beings, fully capable of making their own decisions, then their entire worldview would fall apart. Instead, you get folks like Bart Stupak, who spend a lot of time thinking about abortion without ever wasting a moment asking themselves if it is even possible that women are capable enough of thinking for ourselves that we can ask ourselves hard questions and come to different answers than the one that Bart Stupak demands of us. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. The Bob Marshall is a punishment for the state of Virginia edition. Virginia State Delegate Bob Marshall, in making a speech trying to defund Planned Parenthood, said this.
The number of children who are born subsequent to a first abortion who have handicaps has increased dramatically. Why? Because when you abort the firstborn of any, nature takes vengeance on these subsequent children. In the Old Testament, the firstborn of every deed, animal and man, was dedicated to the Lord. This is a special punishment, Christians would suggest, and with the knowledge that they have from faith.
Let me summarize, in case his point wasn't clear. God makes disabled children to punish women for having abortions. It's hard to count his staggering number of false assumptions, but let me make it clear, disabled people are people, not punishments. And most abortions are not a woman's first pregnancy. 60% of women getting abortions are mothers already.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Check. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.